You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by ProncPops.wordpress.com and KDUX webradio.wordpress.com. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas, with a voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. Welcome to the Pronk Pop Show. This is the Monday edition. By now, you have a vague idea that two people won the French election. I'm going to try to put it in context and relate it to what's happening in the United States, because I think you're seeing a similar pattern here. Although the names and the parties are different, there is a pattern emerging. And I describe it as the elites or the ruling class versus the people, but the news media would like to describe it as nationalism. Some would call it nativism. Others might say popularism versus internationalism or globalism. Now, it's clear to me that the people support nationalism, populism, and the ruling elite certainly support internationalism or globalism, or some even describe it as the New World Order. Take your pick. But at its essence, it's a political conflict between those who control and own the country, and very much the people that work for them and believe they're elite or a ruling class, and the American people. Now, many of you probably think, well, we're a representative republic. We were, and I emphasize were, because today the United States has become, throughout the world, an American empire. And like all empires, they eventually fall. They decline and fall because they overreach. It's expensive to maintain an empire, and in the end, it's simply not worth it. And those who try, and there are many, many that have tried through history, there's a long history of both the rise, decline, and eventual fall of empires. The United States was a relatively young republic. I'm not going to pinpoint the date that we became an empire, but it's certainly around the end of World War II. Sometime between 1945 and today, the United States, sad to say, became the empire, the hegemon, the dominant power throughout the world. And like all empires, it requires a lot of money spent on what we call today the national defense. Now, I'm a big supporter of a strong national defense. I am not a supporter of militarism and trying to intervene in country after country after country. And that's what we've been doing, either through our military, when it requires a large-scale intervention, or the Central Intelligence Agency, that we use as more or less the president's private army to overthrow regimes, or at least change the policy of regimes. Tomorrow and Wednesday, and maybe even Thursday, I'm going to return to what's happening in North Korea. Because one of the things that you need to be careful about, because it repeats itself, is when a country, an empire, gets into trouble, the default setting is time for another war, time for another war. And there are plenty of places to pick from. One is North Korea. The other is the Islamic State of Iran, Syria. Take your pick. Take your pick. It ends up that your sons and daughters, to the extent that they volunteered, we don't have the draft anymore. I think the elites figured it out that the draft was not the way to go, because the people resented it. So today we have an all-volunteer force that can be ordered to go anywhere the president wants. And we are building up to a potential crisis in the Far East around North Korea, Japan, China, Russia, that could easily become a world war. It's a very dangerous situation, and it looks like the United States, under President Trump, is engaged in what, from the outside, from what other people have seen, is either a major bluff or he's ready to attack North Korea. And the danger there is, who are the allies again in North Korea? Communist China and Russia. And the last thing the United States wants, Japan wants, South Korea wants, is a land war in Korea. Because the deaths will be in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions. It could easily escalate into a nuclear confrontation. Now, I'll have more to say about that probably Wednesday or Thursday. I might add some comments tomorrow. But that is what it's looking like could happen. And I just wanted to mention it because it is related to today's topic. So what happened in France? And to put it in a little bit of context, the population of the United States is somewhere between 325 million to roughly 330 million, just ballparking it. The population of France is about 20% of our population. It's about 67, maybe 68 million, somewhere in that neighborhood. And roughly, economically, we obviously have a much larger real gross domestic product, being a larger country. I think the last time I checked, in terms of the entire world, although we make, in terms of population, we're somewhere between 3 and 4% of the world's population, we produce approximately 20% of the world's output. So I wanted to give you the big economic picture because I'm going to get into what's really going on here and what's the concern. And what are the elites decided to do and how they're royally screwing up. Now, I don't, although they're called the elites or ruling class, they have, through their policies and through their control of political parties and their control primarily through campaign contributions, they've royally screwed up their countries, their economies, through foolish and reckless and irresponsible policies. It's not that we can't change those policies. We definitely can. And hopefully President Trump will do it. But I wouldn't hang my hopes, have great expectations that he's going to do it. Because the United States, since Abraham Lincoln, has been a very much a two-party system, and it always will be a two-party system. The question is, what do those two parties stand for, and what do they advocate? Because it's a winner-take-all system. The only moderating aspect is we do have a electoral college, and that's different from what France has, and that is an important difference. Now, if you're a regular listener to the show, you know that I believe in limited government. I believe in a constitutional representative republic. I believe in it. And our presidents, our office holders, swear an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Today, that's a formality because most, not all, but most of them break that oath right after they say it. It's window dressing. It's to give you a warm, fuzzy feeling that we don't have a tyranny. But we do have a tyranny. We have a two-party tyranny. And the two parties are the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And what has happened over time, and it's taken over 100 years to get to where we're at, and I always emphasize that because the temptation is to blame the current set of politicians as the problem. No, this has been going on for many years in both parties, and we've had wars. And what's ratcheted up the size of the government, and that's one of the underlying trend here, is the size of the federal government has gotten bigger and bigger. See, at one time, we didn't have a welfare state in this country. We had a lot of immigration. People know me as a classical liberal. Some would call me a libertarian or for limited government. No. That many libertarians, in theory, support the free movement of goods, services, capital, money, as well as people. And they fully expect that libertarians or classical liberals are for open borders. I'm not. Why not? What's changed? We've had many waves of immigration. I don't have time in this show to go over them, and I'm getting into it because that's one of the issues. One of several that you can spot who are the elitists and who aren't. The elites in this country and in the world are all for open borders, not only for the free movement of goods and services, but for the free movement of people. That's why, within certain limits, they support immigration. Now, I'm a supporter of immigration, legal immigration, but definitely controlled and limited. And the reason is simple. What has changed really since 1965, 68, that time frame, from past waves of immigration in the 1800s and 1900s? Well, the United States in those early years had little or no welfare programs, either at the state or national level. Now, there were some, and many of them were charities and churches, but we really didn't have the government. I prefer saying the state, but that confuses people. They think the state as in Texas. No, I mean the state as the federal government is a state. So is our 50 states a state. I make a distinction, but most people don't get it, so I'll use state and government interchangeably, but I do think of them as somewhat different. They did not provide welfare benefits at all. It has really been, starting with President Hoover, definitely continuing with FDR, Roosevelt, Truman, big time increase with Lyndon Baines Johnson, but also with Nixon. Welfare programs have proliferated. There are literally dozens of them. There's a major one. But we didn't have them, and really, if you want to, since 1929, 1930, and even then, they were small compared to today. Today, about 25%, ballpark. They don't call them welfare programs anymore. It's income security programs. And to a certain extent, I favor them for the truly needy, but we're way beyond that point. Now, how does it relate to immigration? Well, in prior waves of immigration, when people got here, they had to work. It was very much work or starve. You had to become self-reliant. And those that couldn't or could not adapt to this country, couldn't learn the language, for example, or didn't want to learn the language, many of them returned home, at least a third or more. They didn't want to become U.S. citizens, and that's fine. Those that did become U.S. citizens, had children, and today those children are descendants of immigrants. We, almost all Americans, not all, but most Americans, are the children, great-grandchildren, great-grandchildren, on and on, of immigrants. You'll hear the phrase, a nation of immigrants. That's not really accurate. It's really the children, the descendants of immigrants. So there's a general positive support for immigration. Today, about 1.1 million, that's the number you'll hear, come here illegally every year. Now, the American people were not consulted about that. Up until around 1990, the average was around 225,000, 250,000 in that neighborhood. It's only really in the last 25, 27 years that number has gone up. And there are a number of people that want it to go up to 2 million and 3 million. That is the plan of many in the Republican Party. That's why they keep pushing comprehensive immigration reform. That's what they want to do. They do it because they're the donors to their campaigns, the people that own and control this country, make it very, very clear that's what they want. So the ruling elite, the ruling class, wants open borders. Ideally, they would want it to be done legally. And that is the approach that some Republicans want. But if it can't be done legally, and they've tried under George W. Bush and other Republican candidates, they'll support the Democratic Party. They don't really care which party gets the result because they donate to both parties. They buy politicians or they rent them. Either way, they want access and they want something for their money. And politicians are cheap, given the payoffs we're talking about. So the ruling class has an agenda. It doesn't mean everyone in the ruling class agrees to the agenda, but high on that agenda is the increase of the population of the United States through immigration. Legal immigration is actually a small part in terms of the numbers. That's why they want to increase it from 1.1 to 2 to 3, and who knows when, if ever, they stop. But if it can't be done legally, they have no problem with, and the Democratic Party takes this tack, of encouraging people to come here either legally on a visa and overstay, or cross over our borders, primarily the U.S.-Mexican border, come here illegally, in other words, don't present your papers, and then work here. Now, just like in previous waves, many of them don't want to become U.S. citizens. Many do return to their country of origin, especially when the borders are not secured or not really guarded, or they get on an aircraft. Now, they run the risk of not being able to get back in. So the people that truly want to stay here and like it, and that's the majority, that's at least two-thirds or three-quarters, will stay here. They won't go home. They don't want to go home because their home is a hellhole. If they go home and can't get back, it's not nice. Because the United States today has a very generous welfare program, and for their kids, education, that they largely cannot get in their home country, wherever that is. So I'm all for open borders if, and this is the big if, and I know it will never happen, you eliminate the welfare programs. That's not going to happen. And that usually ends the conversation. You see, when we discuss immigration, why it clearly benefits the employer, that's why they keep pushing for comprehensive immigration reform. What's never brought up is the true cost of immigration, both legal and illegal, because a lot of it is welfare, a lot of it is the educational cost, and yes, medical treatment in emergency rooms. Immigration is not free. So the people that benefit, and they benefit mightily in terms of profits by keeping what? Wages low. They want the continued flow of illegals into this country. They prefer that they be here legally, but they'll take what they can get, and they'll contribute to both parties. So you have the Democratic Party has deliberately and intentionally decided that their future in terms of winning elections is getting citizenship for as many illegal aliens that get into the country, as well as legal immigrants. And they're right. Now, big lie media, your major television networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, well as your major newspapers in your large cities, New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, as well as the Wall Street Journal, they support what the elites want. In other words, open borders. And that's what President Obama was doing with his executive orders, and I'll get into executive orders as my second story. I'm going to link this to the French election in a minute, so bear with me. So the ruling class, the people that largely govern this nation, there's a disconnect between them and what I call the American worker or the American people that are not part of the elite. In terms of class, they're either lower class or middle class. Primarily. And it's those two classes, and that's the majority of the country, that are the losers. Because who gets hurt the most when you have millions, actually tens of millions of illegals, as well as legals, entering this country for the last 15 to 20 years, actually over 20 years? The number you'll hear is 11 or 12 million. It's not. No one really knows the exact number. It's been described as trying to count the uncountable. It's somewhere between 30 and 60 million. That is a lot of illegal aliens. That is a lot of votes. Now, some are voting already. There is voter fraud. But they want all of those illegal aliens here, no matter what the number, to become citizens, because in the Democratic Party, they believe that at least, I mean minimum, bare minimum, two out of three will become registered Democrats. And I frankly think it's more like three out of four, and they do too. Maybe one out of four will become a Republican. There are essentially only two parties to select from. I know there are literally several dozen political parties, as there are in France. But because of the way it's winner-take-all, and it's a representative republic, at least in theory, we have two parties. And that won't change until a viable, successful party replaces one, if not both, of the existing parties. That's possible because Gallup every month publishes statistics, polls, as to what is the party affiliation of the American people. I'll summarize it, but the numbers bounce around. A little under 30%. are registered Republicans. Their party affiliation is Republican when a pollster calls them. Usually around 30% or a little more, although it has been going down, are Democrats. To keep it simple, call it 30-30. It's more or less split down the middle. But about 40% call themselves independents. The challenge of independence, and most of them are former Democrats and Republicans, like my situation, but I'm not unique. Many of those independents either won't vote or only will vote if one of the candidates is rather extreme, like extremely socialist. Now, they do lean Democrat and Republican, and to the extent that they vote, they only have those two choices. That's their problem. That's their dilemma. Because until a movement becomes a party, nothing fundamentally will change in this country. You're stuck with the status quo. Yeah, there'll be some changes here and there, and there always are. But your choices are Democrat, Republican, and it's 30-30-40. Now, if the independents had a party and they could attract, let's say, 3/4 of that 40%, you do the math, that means they're at 30-30-30. We have a horse race here. Will that happen? I think it will when, routinely, the independents are 50% or more. Right now, and like I said, it varies from month to month, it's in the low 40s, typically between 40%, 45%. It's been higher than that, and it has been lower. But this is the long-term trend. What's more important to understand is the trend and the fact that the majority today of American people consider themselves independents. They don't want anything to do with the Democratic or the Republican Party. And to the extent that they vote, they tend to vote for the party they came from. But it depends on the candidate. And it also depends on the results in terms of turnout. I didn't vote last time. I couldn't vote for any of them. Because in my mind, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are big government parties. They've turned this country into a warfare and welfare state. You know, the biggest expenditures today, about half of the expenditures are for welfare or warfare. And another roughly 25% are for entitlement programs such as Social Security and Medicare. Medicare is running huge deficits, and Social Security will begin, as in the beginning, to run deficits. What's happening across Europe and in the United States, the welfare state, and in the United States, the welfare warfare state, is going broke. They can't pay for those benefits unless they can find a way to increase the number of workers in the country. That's what they think. They think the answer is either more babies or more immigrants. That will be the solution. It's the wrong idea for the simple reason, if you actually study it, especially illegal but also legal immigrants are big users, consumers of what? Welfare. That requires taxes. Europe is even worse in the sense that their replacement of their population. Women, to replace your population, in other words, don't have it decline, a woman needs to have 2.1 children. Most of the European countries, including Russia, it's way below 2.1. Some are like 1.2, 1.3, 1.4, 1.5, but that's below. And the European countries know that. Their population is getting older. That's why most of them, at least up until now, have opened their borders. They're encouraging immigration. No secret here. They've done the math. We have to get our replacement numbers up to 2.1. Now, in Europe, what ethnic group or what religion has more than 2.1? No secret. Muslims, typically above 3. Now, I'm talking averages here. Some have 4, 5, 6 children. That's not what I'm saying. On average, it's usually a little above 3, 3, 3.5. And France is one country where you have a lot of Muslims coming from North Africa, former French colonies. What they're finding out, though, is a lot of them are not assimilating and, yes, are taking advantage of what? Welfare. That costs money. And we found the same thing in the United States. Now, I want to make clear, I'm not blaming the entire problem on immigration, although it definitely contributes to what's happening. Doesn't make it easier. The elites in this country, largely because the owners of this country want cheap, compliant labor, have made immigration, legal and illegal, a lot easier. And those immigrants compete directly with American citizens, the American worker. The Democratic Party has intentionally abandoned its base, its labor base, its worker base, and emphasize illegal aliens. Now, they don't call them illegal aliens. I call them illegal aliens because that is technically, if you go to the law, what they are. They entered our country without presenting their papers. They're an alien, and when they do that, they become illegal. Now, Donald Trump also calls them criminal illegal aliens. I try to point out that if you enter this country without presenting your papers, you are committing a crime. Yes, first time it's a misdemeanor, second time it's a felony. But that's just the first of several, because if you want to work here, you're going to need papers. In other words, they buy fraudulent documents, driver's license, social security, birth certificates, or steal someone's identity so they can work. And that's the third crime. They don't have a legal status here to work. They don't have a work permit or an employment authorization document to work here. Doesn't stop them. And it's going on across the country, mainly in sanctuary cities. And Dallas County is a sanctuary county. It is somewhat concentrated in around 12 states. Many of them are in the agricultural sector, and that historically has been the case. But many others are in construction, meatpacking, gardening, maintenance, janitorial services. The list is rather long. Maids, cooks, busboys. You get the picture, because many of them are illiterate, don't speak English. They do largely manual labor. Now, some will say, well, Americans won't do that work. To some extent, that's true. I'm not dismissing that. But largely, it's not. Largely, all the jobs I just listed at one time, and in most cases today, would be done by U.S. citizens. And if we didn't have the 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 million, who knows what the real number is, competing directly with American citizens by supply and demand in the labor market, if we didn't have that excess supply, Americans would be earning a lot more money. There's a reason why, when you look at household incomes, it's more or less been slightly declining or been flat for many years now. Doesn't surprise me if you have anywhere from 30 to 50 or 60 million people, and they don't all work. Some are children, some are mothers that are taking care of the children, but somewhere between 20 and 30 million, maybe higher, are working and being taken advantage of, not being paid what they would pay and have to pay an American citizen. Now, let's relate all this to what happened in France. One of the major issues, actually, there were two major issues in the French election. There are many more, but I'm going to zero in on two. One is the high unemployment rate. It's at least 10%. That's a lot of people that can't get jobs. It's hard to compare it to U.S., because our U3 rate is approximately, I think, 4.5%. And our U6 rate, which is the number I tend to use and many economists use, almost twice that. I think it's around, I want to say, 8.6, 8.7. But that even still understates it. So you have much higher unemployment rates in France. That's a big problem. It's compounded by now many, many years, decades, in fact, a very liberal open borders, where a flood of people have been let into the country, largely by the left, the socialists, or the social democrats. They have, like I said, they have different names. Think of them, they're for big government. The candidates are part of the elite, and they favor what? What do they favor? Open borders. They think the answer to saving the welfare state, because of the population, if they didn't open the borders, the population would be declining. You see, if they didn't have access to this flood of labor, what do companies do when there's shortages of labor? They invest in capital to do the jobs that low-skilled workers do. You have a choice. You can either invest in automation or you can hire cheap, compliant immigrants. And different companies make different choices. However, if you didn't have an open borders policy, in other words, you had a strict immigration policy, which I advocate, especially for the United States, it should be limited and controlled. I'm fine with 250,000 or a range of 250,000 to 500,000. 500,000 is where the unemployment rate is under 3%, then yes, encourage more people to immigrate legally. And poll after poll has shown the American people support legal immigration. So who won? Now, if you listen to the news, they'll try to convince you we have two outsiders won. They didn't belong to either the Socialist Party or the Republican Party. And the Republican Party there is roughly the equivalent of the Republican Party here. And that's why it's always dangerous to make these comparisons. The Socialist Party is like the Democratic Party. Their candidates did okay. Well, the Republican candidate did okay. Actually, they both did okay. They got 19.5% of the vote. And France has two rounds. In the first round, you had over a dozen candidates, of which about five really got most of the votes. So the establishment candidates each pulled in 19.5%. So that's about 39% of the vote. But they don't go to the second round. And I do have, for the new listeners, go to prompopops.wordpress.com. Listen to the show, but I have a lot of notes, material, YouTube videos, articles. And if you want the names, I have them. But in your mind, think of the Republican-Democratic equivalents in France and substitute for Democrat-Socialist. They had 19.5%. And those are Fillon and Mélenchon. Actually, Fillon got 20%, and the Socialist candidate got 19.58%. So in round numbers, the establishment candidates got 40%. Now, the so-called outsiders, but be very careful here. Marine Le Pen got 21.3%. Call it 21%. I want to use round numbers here. That's the National Front. She has been compared to Donald Trump. Not really, but why? What are her issues? Immigration are her issues. Open borders are her main issue, including also calling for a vote for the French people to decide whether they still want to be part of the European Union. So the establishment parties, as well as the media there, always call her the far right, the extreme right. But she got more, in terms of percent of the vote, more than either of the two establishment candidates. Now, the person who won, Emmanuel Macron, got 24%. But don't be fooled. Up until last year, he was a socialist. He is definitely part of the establishment, though. Think of him as Barack Obama. Yep, he's a man, but he's white. So the establishment, or ruling class and elite, have no problems with him. So in the second round on May 7th, which is a Sunday, one of these two people are going to win. The conventional wisdom, the polls are all saying it's Macron, Emmanuel Macron. I'm not going to try to imitate the French, and I'm not, because I never could, even though I had taken French in high school, but that was a long time ago. I was not very good in pronouncing or saying it in French. I could write it and read it, but speak it, not very good. Now, the key point here is the French people, and the turnout is much higher. It's about 78%. Our turnout is terrible compared to that. But prior to the election, about 40% were undecided. And that's what you need to keep in mind. There's a lot of undecided people here. And come May 7th, the people that supported the establishment candidate, the Republican candidate, have to make a decision. Do they support Le Pen, a far-right extremist? And I think many of them, most of them will. Let's assume they all do. Now, I know that's not going to happen. That would give Le Pen around 40%, 40, 41%. Macron has 24. If you add the socialists, he has another 20. They're going to go for him. They're not going to go for Le Pen. So it looks like it's 45 versus 40 or 41, a close race. But you have a lot of undecided people that didn't vote in this round, and we're waiting to see what shook out. Now, generally, French politics recently has been in the left. For many, many years, it wasn't. It was on the right. But they're divided. And what is the issue dividing them? Unemployment and immigration. You see, the left in this country wants bigger government, wants open borders, because they know the welfare state is failing. the problem of declining birth rates below the replacement. Now, France is somewhat different than some of the European countries because of the large influx of Muslims. That helps them out. But what about the French workers? They don't like that 10% employment rate. They don't like, over the years, the massive influx of primarily legal immigrants, but also some illegal, working in France. You see, the issues are the same. The parties and the names change. It's very much the people, the workers, versus who? The elites. Now, like the Democratic Party here and the socialists in Europe, they want you to think that they are the party of the workers. But in reality, why that might have been true in the past, it's not true today. They're more concerned about immigration, whether it's legal or illegal. Who gets hurt? The elites of the ruling class do not get hurt. They take care of themselves. They are well off. They're wealthy. They're comfortable, as they are in the United States. They'll come out, and the smart money is Macron will win. Emmanuel Macron. He is sort of a stealth candidate, but in France, they know what he's about. He is not the centrist candidate. He's very much left of center. You better believe it, left of center. He's not a Hillary Clinton, but he would be the youngest male president of France. Now, should we count out Le Pen? No, because I think this race is close. It's not 60%, 40%. That's what the big lie media over there would like you to believe. This is a laydown. He's going to win. I think it's a lot closer. Right now, maybe he has 5 to 10%, somewhere in that range. No more than 10%. But it could be a very close race. It could be. We don't know. If we have a serious terrorist attack, and France has had many of them, where we have hundreds of deaths, and I hope it doesn't happen, that would have a definite impact on the election. So many eyes will be on the French election on May 7th. The smart money is on the socialist in disguise. Has no party. He's a movement. He's the new guy. He's not really a new guy. He's been part of the elite. He was in the administration of the socialists, and the reason why they're doing so poorly, it's not liked. It's been a disaster for France. And even Mélenchon, who got 19.58, he ran as a movement. Now, don't overemphasize that, because you have to look at their history, and most American commentators don't know it. I certainly don't follow French politics. But what I'm trying to identify is the fact that it is very much the elites, the ruling class, versus the people. And this is just one election. As the working class, the workers, realize that their politicians do not have their best interest at heart and are more concerned about immigrants, whether it's legal or illegal, there will arise from a movement a successful, viable third party. We're seeing that in the Le Pen situation, but that party has been around for many years. It's not a new party. I think in the United States, there will be very much a new party challenging the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. I don't know what name they will call themselves. I suggested Independence Party or American Independence Party. The name is not key. It's what they stand for. And if they stand for a constitutional republic, a representative republic, where we control our borders, limit immigration, control it, and most importantly, control government spending and have fundamental tax reform. In other words, if their principles and the issues they run on resonate with the people, they will replace at least one of the parties, Democrat or Republican, because the people are tired of being shafted, lied to, betrayed, and that's what's going on. We're seeing a major realignment across Europe and in the United States, and they center on the failing welfare state, and in the United States, you can add the warfare state to it, and the massive influx of immigrants to the country. And those would be the two issues, and they're together with tax reform and controlling government spending should be the issue or the agenda of this new party. So the French election has a significant impact. A significant impact, but only in a general way. The pattern is what's important here. The details, who knows what the percentages will be. And if it's not this election, it could be the next election. My own opinion is when the number of independents, and you can, the metric I would look at is the Gallup poll, party affiliation, is consistently above 50%, there will emerge a new successful viable party. It will attract conservatives. It will attract classical liberals. It will attract libertarians. It will attract those that believe in limited government, people that believe in fiscal responsibility. It will get much of its support from the Republican Party. But there are many Democrats that will support it if they make immigration and the enforcement of immigration laws part of their agenda, because that benefits who? The workers, the American worker, American citizens. Does that mean they're going to win every election? No. We don't. Right now, there's no party for independents to vote for. It's not like France with a parliamentary system. Oh, France has many parties, but so does the United States. But in the United States, unlike France, there's really two that dominate. You know, the Libertarian Party and the Green Party, they're insignificant. It's winner take all, so it's either a Democrat or Republican. The deck is very much stacked, and that's part of the challenge. You have to overcome that. And one party is going to be replaced. Now, no party wants to be replaced, so they will try to co-opt this movement like they did the Tea Party. The Tea Party went nowhere because both Democrats and Republicans were trying to destroy it, and they used the IRS to do it. A movement maybe could get a president elected, but that's not going to change votes. You want a party that has the votes. It will come about. The question is when. Now, if it doesn't, and it might take too many years before it happens, because government spending is out of control, and there's no real attempt to rein it in, balance the budget, like there's no real attempt to control immigration, nor reform taxes. Eventually, there is a day of reckoning, and at that point, something has to be done, and one or maybe both of the parties will be facing someone that is even stronger than Le Pen is in France. If you ask me, do I think Le Pen's going to win? Not really. Now, I was on record rather early that Trump was going to win both the nomination of his party as well as the election. I didn't vote for him, but I knew he would win because of the issues and because his opposing candidate was the worst that the Democratic Party has had in years. And you don't win elections by calling 50% of your opposition deplorables, a basket of deplorables. Now, I'm looking at the clock. I don't think I'm going to have time to get into the second story. I was going to play a clip, and I still am going to play a clip before I move on. I want to call your attention to both a book, and it's called The Ruling Class, and I want to play a clip from the author about that. Now, his name is Angelo Codavilla, or Codavella. I'm having terrible time today with names. I want to play a short clip about America's ruling class.
Welcome to the American Mind. Thank you, Angelo, for joining us. Your recent celebrated book was called The Ruling Class, How They Corrupted America and What We Can Do About It. What is more shocking or concerning, that a democracy has a ruling class or that our ruling class is defective by your sights?
Democracy, of course, should not have a ruling class. It always has prominent people. But it shouldn't have people who conceive of themselves as different and who have disdain for those below them, for those they rule. After all, the point of any democracy, and our democracy has made that point best, is that all men are created equal. And because of that, they have equal rights. Now, some will be, of course, more prominent than others, wealthier than others, but they ultimately ought to have the same regard for one another. What is distinctive of ruling classes is that they disdain those below them, and our ruling class became a ruling class some people became wealthier than others or more prominent, but when they developed a disdain for those below them and embodied at this day in government.
So every society has a ruling class, from your point of view?
No.
Including democracies?
No. Every society has some people who are more prominent than others, but only non-democratic states, including the European Union, has a class which is self-contained, self-referential, and has disdain for those below them.
And who is the American ruling class?
Well, the American ruling class is characterized not so much by wealth and position, but by a focus on government, focus from which they derive not only power but also personal sustenance, and again, above all, by their attitude toward their inferiors. For example, Ronald Reagan, President of the United States, elected by very large majorities twice. In one case, it was, 46 states that he won. And I recall that when he delivered a pretty strong speech with regard to the Soviet Union, saying that it was an evil empire, and that it was a sad chapter in human history, the last pages of which were about to be written, Strobe Talbott wrote in Time magazine that those were his personal views and did not represent the views of the U.S. government.
Is that
the
right?
The President of the United States did not. And furthermore, he was correct. Strobe Talbott was correct. Ronald Reagan did not represent the views of his government.
So it's not power, so to speak. It's not office holding. What is it then that makes you a member of a
It is a kind of
a ruling class.
More power. Look.
It's an attitude. It's a set of ideas.
It is,
how would
it
you
is,
define it?
It is an attitude, and a recognition of kinship with other like-minded people who are in the ruling class, mm-hmm. who believe that they rule by right, that they are superior.
It's an establishment.
Morally, of course, it's an establishment. Morally and intellectually, that they have a right to tell others what do, how to live, that they know better.
And what's the source of this right in their own minds?
In their own minds, it is certainly a greater kinship with science. The modern ruling class believe themselves to be the priests of science, who can translate. Now, mind you, they are generally scientifically illiterate, but actual knowledge of science means nothing. It is the pretense. Take, for example, global warming. It is one of the tenets that identifies the membership in the ruling class. Never have I spoken with any advocate of global warming. I'm sure there are some who actually knows anything about physics. Or chemistry.
Not to mention climatology.
Never mind climatology. But they assure me that their view is scientific, and that any dissent from it cannot be based on anything but the denial of science.
And so what does that mean politically? What is the political science that justifies rule in their minds?
Well, there really is no justification. The interesting thing about the American ruling class is that it does not tell its subjects, you must obey us for any political reason. You must obey us because we know better, and we really are the truest representatives of the people.
In your description, it seems like many different schools of thought about international relations, as we talk about it these days in the press and in the academy, realists, liberal internationalists, neoconservatives, their differences among themselves are all you call the ruling
class.
Well,
look, there are neoconservatives and liberal internationalists who are not part of the ruling class. Many would like to. But what you're alluding to is the fact that there is an establishment, and that establishment does include the major strains of thought and foreign policy.
But your objection is really not so much to the pretensions of the ruling class, if those pretensions were backed up by success in foreign policy and elsewhere.
No, it would be. Look, my democratic objection to any ruling class would stand. It is redoubled by the fact that these folks have been failures. But what really defines the ruling class is the combination of the attitude with government power. Mm-hmm. Now, there are snobs. There have always been snobs. And one can chuckle at snobbery. But one cannot chuckle at snobbery when that snobbery wields government power.
Well, you've written that the establishment, the ruling class in foreign policy, has been losing wars while winning battles for nearly a century.
Which is quite difficult to do.
Yes, it's an unusual combination. But is it true? I mean, isn't the common sense objection that we won the Cold War? I mean, we won a protracted battle of precisely of the sort that democracies are not supposed to be able to fight or fight well. And the establishment, as you define it, was in control through both political parties and different schools of foreign policy.
Exactly.
Throughout that time. So isn't that a great success in their column?
Well, it certainly looks that way. But when you look at the reality, not the realism, but the reality, you notice...
Good distinction. Yeah.
You notice that the Soviet Union lost it. What actually brought down the Soviet Union was that back in 1964, Leonid Brezhnev made the mistake of telling his party first secretaries to become rooted in their districts. They became rooted in their districts. Mm-hmm. Gorbachev tried to uproot them. That didn't work, and his attempts to uproot them and to regain central control destroy the political basis of
I recommend his book, Angelo Codavilla, The Ruling Class, How They Corrupted America and What We Can Do About It. They are definitely in government. They are the establishment. They're in both parties, Democrat and Republican. And their big supporters are the owners of your large corporations, including those on Wall Street, investment banks, who give to both parties, and they've made a mess of it. And what I mean by that is look at the national debt, which is only a fraction of unfunded liabilities for Social Security and Medicare. Add those two together, you're over $200 trillion. The real GDP of the United States, I don't have the current number, but maybe 10% of that, there's no way we can pay those benefits off. And that's why the welfare state will ultimately fail. It's not going to get any better. It's going to get a lot worse. And there's no real attempt. There's no leadership. They don't know how to get out of the mess that they've created. And it is a mess. And it's very much corrupted. And neither party will confront it. And they don't know how to get out of it. So they ignore it. And it affects you and me. They're afraid of the people. Because when the people truly discover what a mess it is, they're not going to be happy. They fear the people. Even though they think they know best, they don't. They want to tell you what to do as they become the primary beneficiaries of what's happening. The status quo will not change in the United States until we have a viable party to replace one, if not both, of the existing parties. That takes much time, much money, and a lot of dedication. The American people have to stand up to the elites. It's slowly happening in the United States. It's slowly happening in France. But this has been going on for decades. The ruling class, the ruling elite, is not new. Their focus of power is the government, as well as power and money in Wall Street, the large corporations, the media, and it's concentrated. And they do have that attitude. They're superior. They're entitled to it, and they look down on the American people. Again, recall Hillary Clinton's comment, a basket of deplorables. That's one reason she lost. That's rather a foolish thing to say, but that's how arrogant they are. She thought, as did her supporters, as did big lie media, the networks, and the newspapers, that she was going to be the next president, the first woman president. And she shared the values of the elite. She's part of the establishment, but she lost. And this will be the first of many defeats. But if you're expecting fundamental change, I don't hold much hope for Donald Trump and the Republican Party. Donald Trump is very much up against the ruling elite. I said this on the show, and I've said it a couple of times. The day he was sworn in, he immediately had the Democratic Party against him, especially the leadership, the Republican Party leadership against him, and most of the Republican Party, the bureaucracy, the so-called administrative state against him, and you better believe, the owner-donor class, OD, the owner-donor class, the people that own America and buy the politician. That's a lot of power and money opposing him. And he knows it. Because he was very wealthy and successful and had a deal with the ruling class, the power elite in New York City. He knows how the game is played, and he played it. But now he's one person, yes, the president of the United States, up against the ruling class. Oh, he'll try to co-opt it. And notice who he's appointed. Generals, the former chief executive officer of and chairman of Exxon, and others, most of them career politicians, career military, and some wealthy from New York City. Now, that's not a criticism. Where do those people's loyalties belong? Now, he thinks it's to him. I don't think so. It is very much to the ruling elite. And they are trying to delay, stop, sabotage, and if they can, impeach him. He likes to say he has a movement. Well, there are movements in France too, but he doesn't have a party that has votes in Congress. That's why, first, I don't trust him. Second, I'm not optimistic. I have no great expectation. It would be a miracle if he accomplishes a small fraction of his agenda. How has he done it so far? And that's the second story. Mostly by executive orders. And I have some statistics on it. I was kind of curious. I'm not against executive orders, especially if they're publicly disclosed, and that's a key proviso. I was kind of curious, though, in terms of numbers, who issued the most? Now, not surprisingly, I would have said Roosevelt, FDR, and that was true. Remember, he had four terms. And I was not surprised that Woodrow Wilson was second. They were for big government. They were definitely for big government. One was president during World War I, a second was president during World War II. That's why I'm concerned that one of the ways when you're in a crisis situation is to get the country into another war, because that enables them to control you and me. You better believe it. Spend more money, tax you, regulate you, control you. Now, what's interesting, the third president is one who I think is one of the best presidents of the last century, and that's Calvin Coolidge, who is just the opposite. So you can't judge by the number of executive orders. It's what they cover. And they're largely directions to the various secretaries, departments, and agencies as to what the president wants to accomplish, what his goals are, and what specifics are. And to the extent that they're well publicized, and they have been, that's good. I'd rather have transparency, that you know what the president is doing, than not have that visibility as to what the president is doing. Now, some of the more famous ones, he definitely wants that pipeline built. I'm all for that pipe, actually two pipelines. And he's also instructed the IRS to not collect the penalties if you don't buy Obamacare health insurance. And he's issued many, many other executive orders. He's been very busy in his first 100 days. Now, I don't give much credence at all to this 100-day period. However, he needs to accomplish much of his agenda in his first year because he's up against both parties. He can't expect any help from the Democratic Party. It's not going to happen. And why he does have a support is in the Republican Party. Remember, most of the Republican establishment did not want Donald Trump as their candidate. They fought him. Now they're all slapping his back and smiling because some of what they want to get passed will be signed. But fundamentally, the status quo, I don't think, is going to change that much. We'll see. One of the tests will be the wall that Donald Trump wants to build, a little under 2,000 miles. Now they're calling it a barrier. I don't care what you call it. It just has to work. And that requires patrols, cameras, sensors. Because no matter what barrier you have, people will find a way over it. Over it, under it, or through it. But if it's high enough and difficult to climb, then with cameras and with the Border Patrol patrolling it, many, if not most, of the illegal aliens that have been flooding into this country over the last 20 years can and should be stopped. It's a first step. I'm looking at, as well as a lot of American people are looking at, whether or not Donald Trump gets that wall built. Now, he keeps repeating he's going to do it. And many thought he was going to make it an issue, the funding of it. In this budget year, we have 5 months remaining. Remember, this budget year, 2017, ends 30 September. So we have a little over 5 months. Democrats want to shut the government down. Schumer, in particular, wants to shut the government down, and the issue being the wall. It's a waste of money. Trump, I think wisely, says, I won't make it an issue now. I'll make it an issue in the next budget. That gives him time, plenty of time in my mind, to review the plans for this wall, barrier, fence, double fence, whatever, and make sure it really will stop the invasion of this country. Now, if you listen to the news, the number of illegal aliens crossing over the border from Mexico is way down. I hope it's true. But it prior to this administration, if you talk to the U.S. Border Patrol, they would tell you, for every one that they apprehended at the border, three got away. A minimum of three. The average, five. And prior to the Obama administration, the average apprehension rate for a year was an average of around a million. Some years a lot higher, some years a little bit lower, but on average around a million. So if a million were caught or apprehended, that means the average was about 3 million were not caught. In other words, made it to Dallas or other points, other cities. Remember, Dallas, not the city, but the county, is a sanctuary city. And they're here. I can attest to it. They're very much here. So the people that supported Donald Trump are watching. Donald Trump is an outsider. This is the first office he ran for and got elected. No one or hardly anyone thought he could get the nomination, and even fewer thought he could win. I'm not in that camp. I was rather early, said I think he's going to win because he picked the right issues. I think he could have, and he got a mandate. 306 electoral votes when you only need 270 is a mandate. So the first 100 days of Donald Trump, and he still has a few more. It's not over. We're in, 92 or 3? I've lost track. It's been filled with executive orders, and we'll have a lot more. A lot of those executive orders were undoing the executive orders of Barack Obama. The one that really sticks out is that pipeline. But the same in terms of immigration and trade, and there will be others. And I've given you a sample of some of the videos discussing the various executive actions. I applaud his executive actions. We know what he's doing as opposed to what some presidents have schemed. You can hide it by not issuing executive orders. There's a record here, folks, and that's what you want. I applaud transparency and visibility into what the President of the United States is doing, especially if it's legal and constitutional. My fear is when presidents issue executive orders and it's clearly unconstitutional and contrary to public law. That's the real tyranny. So you need to be aware of what the president is doing. And as he signed these executive orders, and I think he's up to 25, but that doesn't seem right. That's kind of low. I think he's made good progress, and I expect a lot more in the nature of an executive order. What I fear, though, because it's happened in the past, if he doesn't fight for the money in the budget for fiscal year 2018 that ends next September 30th, then my suspicions that he's going to double crosses on immigration by going along with the ruling class, going along with the Republicans, going along with the establishment of both parties, and coming out for touchback amnesty. That's when we'll really know. The wall is an initial indication how serious he is. I don't think he can truly back down on that. Whether it's actually built for the entire little under 2,000 miles, that remains to be seen. And you better believe that big lie media will make sure that they point out the holes in the barrier or fence. But the real test is, does President Trump roll back the invasion of 30 to 60 million illegal aliens that are currently in the United States and working, that obey the law, except they don't obey the immigration law? I'm all in favor of setting priorities and going after those that have records, whether in their country of origin or in the United States. And that, in my mind, is maybe 2 to 3 million people, a small percentage of those that are here. But what about everybody else? They have broken many laws, first to get here, the documents to work, and then working here. And they compete directly with the American worker, the American citizens, and that's not right. And they also compete with immigrants that have come here legally and followed the rules. I'm for very much the rule of law and honoring your oath of office to preserve and protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. We've had several presidents that have not lived up to it. Because right in the Constitution, it's the responsibility of the federal government to defend the states and the people of the states against invasion. And we've had an invasion of this country. So immigration will remain a wedge issue in this country for many years to come, as will it be an issue in not only France, but many, if not all, of the European countries. The answer is to invest, make the American people more productive, and downsize and control government spending. The ruling elites, whether in the United States of America or in France, United Kingdom, and other European countries, they are an elite. They look down upon their people. They think they know best, and they don't. The welfare state is failing, and they're panicking. And the same is true of the warfare and welfare state in the United States. If we want peace and prosperity, a rising standard of living, we have to return to the Constitution, to the principles of the Founding Father, and make the American Empire again an American Republic. Will it happen? I'm not optimistic. I am not optimistic. It is up, really, to the American people to decide whether they will unite, organize, and return our country to a representative republic under the United States Constitution. With that, thank you for listening. And now, America the Beautiful.
My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas, with a voice of Richland College. You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by PronkPops.wordpress.com and KDUX Web Radio.wordpress.com.